Hi, you're listening to Radio Looks Lucid. I'm your host, Steve Matthews. Today is Saturday, October the 8th, 2016, and this is episode number 13. The title of this episode is Immigration, Citizenship, and the Bible, Part 5, Various Immigration Proposals. In last week's podcast, I had looked at the immigration proposals of Hillary Clinton. The week prior to that, I had looked at the immigration proposals of Donald Trump, and I won't go back and rehash all that right now. But I mentioned those things just to introduce this week's podcast. This week's podcast is based on the blog post on immigration that I put up on the blog. That would have been on Sunday, October the 2nd. And again, the title of that blog post is Immigration, Citizenship, and the Bible, Part 5, Various Immigration Proposals. My point in that article that I wrote last week is to move away from some of the candidates' positions. I'd wanted to talk about Clinton and Trump, just because that's such a prominent issue right now in American politics, and I thought it was worthwhile taking a look at what they had to say. But what I'd like to do here at this point is take a look at what others have to say about immigration, other thinkers, I should say, to be a little bit more specific. There are other schools of thought on immigration, and so I wanted to tackle a few of those here. I'm going to be doing that in this week's podcast, and tomorrow when I write my blog article, I'm going to be continuing that portion of the discussion on immigration, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about that at the close of this podcast. So looking at what I had written last week, I did do a little bit of a recap on the Roman church states approach to immigration. One of the important things, and I think this is really necessary when you're talking about analyzing what Rome has to say about immigration, is that when studying anything that the Roman Antichrist has to say about immigration, it's imperative for Protestants, or for anyone for that matter who's looking at their writing and their thinking. It's imperative, though, for Protestants to understand that Rome has a very different worldview than probably what they do. And I made the point, I'm just going to read a brief paragraph here, that even if they've not thought about it deeply, most Protestants tend to think in terms of what's called Westphalian sovereignty when it comes to international relations. Now, Westphalian sovereignty is simply a technical name for what most Americans would probably call foreign policy common sense. And there's a definition of Westphalian sovereignty. I'll just read it to you. This is from Wikipedia. I think it's a pretty good definition. Quote, Westphalian sovereignty is the principle of international law that each nation state has sovereignty over its territory and domestic affairs, to the exclusion of all external powers, including all external religious powers, that's my little addition there, including all external religious powers, on the principle that non-interference in another country's domestic affairs, and that each state, no matter how small, is equal in international law. So basically what that says is that the U.S. is to mind its own business and handle its own internal affairs, and Canada is to mind its own business and handle Canada's internal affairs, and Mexico and the Mexicans have the right to govern their country the way they see fit. In other words, it's the job of the United States to mind its own business. And of course, that was the policy of the United States really up until getting toward the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, when the U.S. began to get into the business of empire. That's a little bit outside the scope of this particular paper, but I did want to talk to you a little bit about Westphalian sovereignty. And I bring that up because, of course, Westphalian sovereignty was established at the end of the 30 Years' War. The 30 Years' War was a war fought between Protestants and Catholics, essentially, and the Protestants won, and basically they prevented Rome from meddling in the affairs, the internal affairs of the Protestant nations of Europe. And of course, as you might expect, Rome didn't take very kindly to that. Rome has never really accepted Westphalian sovereignty, and that continues up to this very day. And what you have to do then is you have to understand that that rejection of Westphalian sovereignty, the idea that a country has a right to govern its own business, to mind, you know, to take care of its own internal affairs to the exclusion of external powers, Rome rejects that. When Rome looks at the Americas, what they do is just see a great big gigantic landmass. You know, kind of like if you looked at space and you took a photograph from outer space and you looked down, you'd see North America, Central America, and South America, but you wouldn't see anything that was really a border, unless maybe, I suppose, it was a natural border, maybe like the Rio Grande River or something. But they just look at it as one big gigantic landmass. And they believe that people should simply be able to just move around, and that there should be no ability of the United States, or any other country for that matter, to do anything about that. And I put on here that there is a bit of a process that Rome likes to use. And we talked a little bit about that in some of the earlier posts, but just briefly, what they first do is they flood a nation with immigrants, Roman Catholics if possible, but any sort will do. You know, and then once they've flooded the country, the second thing they do is, you know, there's these gigantic welfare states in the United States, and in Europe as well, but they're just talking here about the United States. There's this gigantic welfare state. So you have all these people come in, begin to live off the welfare state. And, of course, naturally that provokes a certain amount of citizen outrage, as it should. And when Americans complain about the economic and social cost of the mass immigration, you know, Rome then proceeds to lecture them on their lack of Christian charity. And one of the ways that they do this, that is Rome, one of the ways Rome lectures Americans on immigration is they twist the scriptures. And what they do is they try to argue that welfare immigrants or migrants or refugees are simply doing the same thing that Joseph did when he took Mary and Jesus and fled to Egypt to get away from Herod and his murderous intentions. And of course, Rome is also quick to bring up lots of verses from the Old Testament to talk about caring for the stranger, and this type of thing. But there's a number of problems with this, and I'll come back and talk about those later. So I'll just kind of leave it at that. A second ploy that Rome would like to use is, of course, bring out charges of racism. And so, you know, what they say is, essentially, the only reason that you object, this is what Rome says, the only reason that you object as an American to all these Mexicans or maybe people from other parts of the world coming in, is you're just a bunch of bigots. You know, you're sort of that Hillary Clinton deplorable basket, and you just hate people, and you're filled with xenophobia and racism. That's a pretty effective charge, and it gets a lot. It intimidates a lot of people, and then of course the third step in the process that they use is I call it wash, rinse, repeat. You know, they just continue to cycle through those first two processes until essentially they've elected a new people. They brought in so many immigrants from so many different parts of the world that they've radically changed the electorate. And I think ultimately the goal of Rome is to make countries ungovernable and then fold them into a world government system. That's at least my view of it. So that's basically Rome's approach to immigration. And that strikes me as a very strange approach, but I think it's wrong. I think it can be easily refuted from the scriptures, and we'll talk a little bit about that. But I did just want to kind of walk through a little bit of what Rome does in using immigration. I mean, it's, you might even call it weaponized immigration. I mean, for Rome, immigration is a weapon that they use to essentially knock down the knock down nation states, to break nation states and make them more easily make them easier targets for globalism. And of course, Rome, you know, they are the biggest and the best and the oldest and the original globalists. You know, we hear a lot about globalism. And it's kind of interesting if you listen to the alternate media, maybe you read blogs or listen to podcasts, maybe you watch some YouTube channels, this sort of thing, you'll find a lot of people that talk about globalism, and there's some good stuff out there, but very few people, hardly anyone really, takes the time to look at the globalist pretensions of Rome. But believe me, Rome is very serious about creating a one-world government. They've called for that multiple times. And of course, they want themselves in the catbird seat, as you might expect. Moving on, though, from Rome, there was a second group of people that I talked about last week. And these were liberal Protestants. I also dubbed the liberal Protestants sort of the social justice warrior religious left. And the thing that's interesting, or, well, a thing that's interesting about the social justice warrior religious left, is that there's not a great big difference between what they say and what Rome says. And I used as an example of the religious left, I used an example, there's a website, it's called Evangelicals for Social Action. So they purport to be evangelicals. And I supplied a link there in the blog article. And if you look on their website, there is a document. It's about the main section of their website called Immigrants and Refugees, and Evangelicals for Social Action. I'll just call them ESA for short here going forward. ESA opens its immigration discussion really by smearing Americans with the charge of, as you probably guessed, racism. Here's a quote from ESA's website. Quote, "For a country that prides itself on its immigrant past, on welcoming those huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the United States as a whole is surprisingly and persistently xenophobic." Now, for those of you who maybe don't know Greek, xenophobic is just Greek for racist. It means a fear of a stranger or a fear of the foreigner. And really, it's pretty much just a synonym for racist. So it's not a nice term to use on someone. ESA. Now, of course, there are people in the United States who are racist. You can find those people in any country. It's not just in the United States. On the other hand, you know, I think it's worth asking this. You know, if the U.S. is filled with so many horrible, hateful, terrible, bigoted, xenophobic, racist people, why is America still the world's most popular destination for immigrants? I found an article on the Huffington Post. Now, the Huffington Post is if you're not familiar with it, that's a really left-wing, kind of a liberal, politically liberal website. I'll just read from you from the Huffington Post. This is a quote. Quote, "The U.S. is by far the largest destination for immigrants, with more than 45.7 million living in the country, according to the UN. Considering the U.S. has one of the highest per capita GDPs in the world at nearly $50,000, its appeal to immigrants is fairly straightforward." End quote. So, I mean, here you go. You've got the United States with this huge immigrant population. So apparently all these people just can't wait to get to the United States and deal with all those horrible, dreadful, evil, terrible, deplorable racists that are over here. You know, the Roman Catholic Church thinks Americans are a bunch of racists. The liberal Protestants think everybody in the United States is a bunch of racists. Hillary Clinton thinks everyone's a bunch of racists, or at least half of Donald Trump's supporters, I think she said. They were in the deplorable basket. So that works out to about a quarter of the nation. So, you know, according to Rome and the social justice warrior religious left and Hillary Clinton, we're all just, Americans are... A pretty good chunk of the American population is in the basket of deplorables. They all three agree on that. interestingly enough. And of course, they all three are very big on open immigration. Now, I'm for open immigration in a sense, but open immigration also requires the elimination of a lot of the laws that the liberals hold most dear, starting with the welfare state. You cannot, and this is Milton Friedman made this observation. Milton Friedman was a Nobel Prize winning economist of the Chicago School. And I disagree with a lot of things that Milton Friedman said. And I think he was right on target, though, with this point. And he said, you cannot have open immigration in a welfare state. Because you just import all these people, and then they go on the welfare rolls. They go on the dole. That's a very serious problem. And so you cannot have open immigration with a welfare state. But, of course, the Roman Catholic Church state, the social justice warrior religious Protestants, and Hillary Clinton, none of those people would even dream of cutting so much as a dime from the welfare state. And so in a case like that, their program has to be entirely rejected by the voters, or otherwise there's not going to be a country around. There will not be a United States, at least not in the form that we have known it up until now. Going back to the ESA, the Evangelicals for Social Action, they actually produced about a 30-page document, and you can find it right in the immigration portion of the website. But it has a title. It's called "As the Citizen Among Us: Loving the Immigrant as Ourselves," and it's filled with just. I'll spare you all the gory details in it, but it's just a lot of. It's a lot of leftist gobbledygook, I guess. Maybe that's, for lack of a better term, that's what I would think of it. It's really a lot of touchy-feely, social justice warrior-y, safe spacey kind of thing. It's actually pretty embarrassing. There's nothing evangelical about it. You know, when I use the term evangelical historically means someone who believes in justification by faith alone and the scriptures alone. And really, the ideas put forth by the ESA and its website and in this 30-page document on immigration, there's nothing biblical about it. It's really just a lot of warmed-over leftism. You know, kind of dressed up with a little evangelical garb, and somehow we're supposed to think that this is biblical. Well, it's nothing of the sort. So let's see, what did ESA have to say in its 30-page brochure here? Oh, I see. Really, right at the end of the document, it's on page 27, Appendix A, there's something called the Immigrant's Creed. And I'll just quote a little bit from you. It was written by a gentleman by the name of José Luis Casals. Now, they identify this fellow. It says that he's a pastor and general missioner of the Presbytery of Tres Rios in Midland, Texas, of the Presbyterian Church USA. So he's a PCUSA liberal writing this thing. But this is his immigrant creed. He says, quote, "I believe in Almighty God, who guided the people in exile and in Exodus, the God of Joseph in Egypt and Daniel in Babylon, the God of foreigners and immigrants." I don't know. I guess apparently he's the God of foreigners and immigrants only. I guess he's not the God of people who actually are native to a particular nation. at least that's kind of what you might get when you read that first paragraph. But Casals continues, and he says, goes on, he says, quote, "I believe in Jesus Christ, a displaced Galilean who was born away from his people and his home, who fled his country and with his parents when his life was in danger, and returning to his own country, suffered the oppression of the tyrant Pontius Pilate, etc." But he goes on in sort of in this fashion, and he talks about, "I believe in the communion of the saints begins when we accept the diversity of the saints." So he's something of a cultural Marxist as well. He slips that kind of language in. It's really, I don't know, if it weren't weren't so sad, it might be a little bit comical. But, he talks about Jesus Christ being a displaced Galilean. And this is really this is an argument that's not original. And one of the things, I think maybe I mentioned this before, I know I put it in the blog post. One of the things when you read through this stuff by organizations like ESA is that their ideas aren't even original. This stuff is really derivative, essentially a lot of the language that they use, it's just borrowed right from the Roman Catholic Church state. It's not even anything they came up with on their own. Evangelical scholarship is really pathetic, a lot of it anyway, and I think certainly ESA is pretty pathetic. And just to kind of give you a flavor of just how derivative so much of what ESA says is, let me quote from a Roman Catholic document that says pretty much the same thing as the Immigrants' Creed. There was an apostolic constitution written by Pope Pius XII in 1952. And some people, there's a book out that is a commentary on this particular piece, this constitution. It's called Exul Familia. Exul Familia, that's a Latin term. It means the immigree family, or the family in exile, or the refugee family might be another way of rendering the Latin there. And Exul Familia talks about how the family, Joseph and Mary, Joseph who took Mary and Jesus and fled, how this family is really an archetype or a symbol. This is what they argue. It's not my argument. This is the Roman Catholic Church's argument. They say that the flight of the Holy Family from into Egypt is sort of representative of all immigrants today, all migrants or refugees today. Let me read you a brief quote from the Roman Catholic document Exul Familia, just to kind of give you a flavor of this. This is just the opening paragraph of the work. The emigree Holy Family of Nazareth, fleeing into Egypt, is the archetype of every refugee family. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, living in exile in Egypt to escape the fury of an evil king, are, for all times and all places, the models and protectors of every migrant, alien, and refugee of whatever kind who, whether compelled by fear of persecution or by want, is forced to leave his native land, his beloved parents and relatives, his close friends, and to seek a foreign soil. And I took that out of, there's actually, I mentioned there was a book out called The Church's Magna Carta for Migrants. That title is the title of a book that's a commentary on Exul Familia. So Exul Familia is really a very important foundational document to the Roman Catholic Church state's teaching on immigration. It's really their application of Roman Catholic social teaching to the whole issue of immigration, migration, and asylum seekers. It's interesting to see, when you read that paragraph there, that the liberal Protestant Jose Luis Casals really lifted a lot of his language, lifted his basic ideas right out of Exul Familia, right out of Antichrist's statement on immigration. They both agree, that is, the liberal Protestants and the Romanists, they both agree that the flight to Egypt by the family of Jesus is a model for the sort of taxpayer-subsidized mass immigration and migration that's going on in Europe and the U.S. But, of course, that raises the question, is that really a legitimate comparison? I mean, is what the family... Jesus' family did when fleeing Herod, really the same thing as, say, people crossing over from, illegally crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S. Is that the same thing? Well, Rome would have you think that it is, and the social justice warrior liberal Protestants would have you think that it is, but I would say not so fast. And I give a few reasons here in the blog post. For one, when Joseph and his family went for Egypt, they were really fleeing not from one country to another, but really to different provinces within the Roman Empire. You know, it wasn't as though they were going from you know, fleeing between nations. At the time of the first century, both Judea and Egypt were provinces of the Roman Empire. So they were really all part of one great big empire. They were not fleeing from one nation, one independent nation, to another independent nation. So that's a point that I think is overlooked by the Romanists and the social justice warriors. Second, too, it's a bit of a stretch to compare the movement of three people, Joseph and his family, his wife and the young Jesus. It's very difficult to compare the flight of three people to the millions of individuals pouring into Western Europe, say the Syrian refugees or other Muslim refugees from other areas of the world, or in the United States to all of the people pouring into the United States. I mean, the United States has currently an illegal immigrant population somewhere around 12 million people. So 3 million people versus, you know, 12 million in the U.S. and however many million in Europe, that's, you know, just the sheer scale of the issue really doesn't, I think, make for a very good comparison. And really as a follow-up point, you know, it's not as though you can't find examples in the Bible of a mass migration. I mean, if Rome really wanted to look at a mass migration, you know, a big group of people moving from one nation to another nation, well, there's a very obvious example in Scripture, and it's not the flight of Jesus' family from Judea to Egypt, but it's, well, quite literally a mass exodus. You know, we use that term mass exodus. Well, there was a mass exodus in the Bible. And where do you find it? Well, you find it in the book of Exodus. You find, you know, when Israel left Egypt. And I don't have the numbers right here in front of me, but I think if you look at the numbers the Bible provides, I think the total number of people who of Hebrews, of Israelites who left Egypt under Noah or Noah under Moses, excuse me, under Moses' leadership, I think it was over a million people. I mean, it was a big group of people. You know, and so on in terms of scale, I mean, I think that would be a much better example to look at when we're talking about migration versus what Joseph did in taking his family to Egypt. The other thing is this, the third point I wanted to make, is that there's not so much a hint in Scripture that the family, that Christ's family, Jesus' family went on the public dole when they went into Egypt. You know, the Bible doesn't tell us anything about how they lived there. Now, there had been since, for really a very long time, at least since the fall of Jerusalem, and maybe even before that, but certainly since the fall of Jerusalem, there had been a substantial Jewish population in Egypt. You may have heard of the Septuagint, for instance. The Septuagint was the first time the Old Testament was ever translated, and it was translated from Hebrew into Greek. And it was done, I believe, in about the 3rd century B.C., and it was done in Alexandria. Alexandria was one of the great centers of learning of the ancient world. Alexandria was kind of like, oh, like Cambridge or Harvard or Oxford, you know, one of the great university towns, one of the great places of learning in the ancient world. It was Alexandria in Egypt. And at least the tradition goes that there were 70 Hebrew scholars that worked on translation and 70 Greek scholars, and some other people like to say that there were some who had no knowledge of either language, but that's kind of an ancient joke, I guess, at the expense of the Septuagint. But anyway, my main point is, going back to my main point there was a big Jewish population in Egypt, and you know, it's possible maybe they went there and stayed with relatives. Maybe they had family there. The Bible just doesn't say. But there wasn't any welfare state such as what we have today. When they went to Egypt, and I don't know how they survived, but they didn't survive on the dole. And we can say that with confidence simply because of the fact that the Bible everywhere teaches, as Paul said explicitly in the New Testament, if he who will not work, let him not eat. You know, the Bible never advocates a welfare state. And so whatever means Jesus' family was supported, you know, whether they stayed with relatives or maybe God had directed them to a family that would care for them, maybe God miraculously provided for them, we just don't know. But there's absolutely no reason to think that Joseph and his wife and Jesus went to Egypt and went on the public dole. But that's exactly what happens with today's mass welfare immigration. When people come into the United States, when people go on to Europe, they are immediately able to apply for different types of benefits. Now, in the United States, illegal immigrants are technically not allowed to get welfare, but they still can receive free medical treatment. And, of course, if they have a child in the United States and that child is a U.S. citizen, even if the parent's immigration status is still illegal, they can request welfare benefits on behalf of the child. And those welfare benefits are fungible. You know, the parents can use those for themselves, too. And of course, the federal government mandates that U.S. schools are required to educate the children of illegal immigrants, and so there are lots of benefits that someone can get by moving to the United States, even though illegal immigrants are not maybe directly able to get welfare. There still is a significant amount of free stuff available to them. And, of course, if they have a child, there's even more free stuff available to them. There was no welfare state like that in existence back in the first century AD. And the social justice warriors and the Romanists conveniently forget that. Kind of moving on here. Let's see. Here's another quote from Rome, and this is, again, just to show that both Rome and liberal Protestants basically agree that that anyone who objects to their immigration schemes are racists. Let me read this to you. This is a short quote. This is from a Roman Catholic document called Strangers No Longer. It was written by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops together with their colleagues from Mexico. The document is a joint document issued back in 2003, and it basically lays additional groundwork for immigration and migration into the United States. Quote, many persons who seek to migrate are suffering, and, in some cases, tragically dying. Human rights are abused, families are kept apart, and racist and xenophobic attitudes remain. End quote. So that was Rome accusing Americans of being a bunch of racists and xenophobes, and compare that to what the liberal Protestants had to say. I'll read the liberal Protestant statement again. This is from the Evangelicals for Social Action. Quote, for a country that prides itself on its immigrant past, the United States as a whole is surprisingly and persistently xenophobic. So ESA thinks Americans are xenophobes. The Roman Church State, the Antichrist Roman Church State, thinks Americans are xenophobes. Of course, the American people are slandered by both groups. That about wraps it up here for today. I don't want to go too much longer. Lord willing, tomorrow I intend to write another piece. This will be part six of the series on immigration, citizenship, and the Bible. And this particular installment is going to look at conservatives. You know, we've taken a look at what some liberal Protestants have to say. Well, we're going to take a look at what some conservative Protestants have had to say about immigration. In particular, we're going to take a look at the Southern Baptist Convention. I'm going to pick on them a little bit tomorrow and see what they had to say about immigration. Maybe we can talk about a few other conservative groups as well and see what the, how their ideas stack up against the liberals. So that's all here for this week. Until I talk to you next time, I did want to let you know that may the Spirit of Truth guide you in all truth as you read and study God's Word. I leave you with that thought. Thanks for listening. Until next time.